happy talk, keep talking happy talk. Talk about things you'd like to do.
Live in the moment, we're told, but we don't, do we? And why should we, after all? Homo sapiens is the only animal, really, that contemplates the future. And because of this, we created a civilization, more civil at certain times than others. But we have systems of government and justice that take both our past and our future into consideration when meeting out justice and our place in society. But because of this, we tend to worry about the future. Someone who has studied our proclivities for anxiety and happiness is Martin Seligman. He's a psych professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's written an article in the New York Times, an essay really, that he co-wrote with John Tierney, who is a New York Times science columnist, about this proclivity for maybe over-contemplating our future, or maybe drawing certain conclusions that we needn't about it. And I'm going to quote from that article tonight on this My Sharon Hour, just starting. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only FM public radio station, KX935. Seligman suggests that instead of Homo sapiens, literally wise man, we should call ourselves Homo prospectus, because looking into the future, either consciously or unconsciously, is, according to psychologists and neuroscientists, a central function of our particularly large brain. And this power of prospection is what makes us wise. It also makes us prisoners of the past and the present, because it's hard for us to get out of ourselves and imagine a future where we could be different. If you listen to my show on animals, you'll realize that most animals are Pavlovian. Their learning is the ingraining of habit by repetition. And of course, psychoanalysts believed that treating and curing patients was largely a matter of unearthing and confronting the past in order to get them to adjust to new ways of thinking and habits. But still, cognitive psychology was focused on the past and present, on memory and our perceptive abilities. But it's become apparent that our minds are drawn mainly to the future, and they're not driven by the past. What we do with the past, with our memories, is use them to imagine future possibilities, to prospect, to focus on the unexpected. Therapists are now exploring new ways to treat depression now that they see it as primarily not induced by past traumas and present stresses so much as because of our skewed visions of what the future will hold because of our pasts. What prospection, looking to the future, does is give us a chance to learn not just from our own experiences, but from our colleagues and associates and friends. Now, we're not the only animal that can think of the future. It's just we're the only animal that can think of it years and miles ahead. We know that squirrels bury nuts by instinct, by evolutionary impulses, not because they figured it's 4 or 5 months ahead to winter. Same with the ants. They're genetically programmed to build colonies. There was a chimpanzee in a Swedish zoo who stockpiled rocks so that he could throw them at gawking humans. And chimps can spend a lot of the day searching and waiting for their next meal, but they're not able to make dinner reservations for a week ahead. That's something that we humans have to collaborate on. The restaurant manager has to be able to see how many tables are going to be filled on that day, and we have to know that we're going to be available on that day and make plans with our friends to be available to join us. That's some quite complicated scheduling that, as far as we know, we humans are the only ones capable of. The chef has to know to cook for X number of people and has to know that he or she will be paid by somebody accordingly and that his or her landlord will accept the stockpiling of that payment as monthly rent and even require a deposit from you at the prospect of your paying that monthly rent for the year and maybe years to come. If we didn't consider our futures, we'd all be homeless and foodless in our homes. Quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935, talking tonight about the future and the peculiarly human ability to plan for it and at different times look forward to it or worry about it. If you're depressed and anxious, you're going to have a rather bleak view of the future, and that's a catch-22 because that also affects your present. It's actually not the present that causes the trauma, because while you're living it, it's a vital thing and your body is helping you get through it, even strengthening you once you emerge from it. It's our predictions of failure and rejection that end up being more traumatic when all we see ahead is danger and risk, and this can paralyze us. Martin Seligman gives the example of a bright and accomplished student who nevertheless can't stop thinking, if I flunk the next test, then I'll let everybody down and show what a failure I really am. The only way to refute that negative thinking when it happens to you is to envision a positive outcome by envisioning that you're going to pass the test, or think of all the possibilities that will remain to you even if you don't. But that's if you're conscious about your negative thinking. Also, if you know what's coming. Seligman gives the example that you don't laugh when you tickle yourself because you're already prepared for what's coming. But how can we be prepared for what's coming in this current age where machinery, automation, is basically taking over our lives? Let's hear what futurist, inventor, entrepreneur, businessman, scientist Elon Musk has up his sleeve and his attitudes to it all. Brought to you now on this Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935 via Musk's TED Talk with TED Master Curator Chris Anderson. Here's the first question Chris asks him.
So, why are you boring?
I ask myself that frequently.
Obviously, Chris is joking and that's a pun.
We're trying to dig a hole under LA, and this is to create the beginning of what will hopefully be a 3D network of tunnels to alleviate congestion. I mean, right now, I think one of the most soul-destroying things is traffic. It affects people in every part of the world. It takes away so much of your life. It's horrible. It's particularly horrible in LA. So there are a couple of key things that are important in having a 3D tunnel network. First of all, you have to be able to integrate the entrance and exit of the tunnel seamlessly into the fabric of a city. So by having sort of a car skate that's on an elevator, you can integrate the entrance and exits to the tunnel network just by using two parking spaces. And then the car gets on a skate. There's no speed limit here. So we're designing this to be able to operate at 200 kilometers an hour, about 130 miles per hour. So you should be able to get from, say, Westwood to LAX in 6 minutes, 5-6 minutes. You can go much further deep than you can go up. The deepest mines are much deeper than the tallest buildings are tall. So there's no real limit to how many levels of tunnel you can have. You can alleviate any arbitrary level of urban congestion with the 3D tunnel network. This is a very important point. A key rebuttal to the tunnels is that if you add one layer of tunnels, then that will simply alleviate congestion, it'll get used up, and then you'll be back where you started, back with congestion. But you can go to any arbitrary number of tunnels, any number of levels.
But people assume traditionally it's incredibly expensive to dig, and that would block this idea.
Well, they're right. To give you an example, the LA subway extension, which is, I think it's a 2.5 mile extension, that was just completed for $2 billion. So it's roughly $1 billion a mile to do the subway extension in LA. And this is not the highest utility subway in the world. So, it's quite difficult to dig tunnels normally. I think we need to have at least a tenfold improvement in the cost per mile of tunneling.
And how could you achieve that?
Actually, if you just do two things, the first thing to do is to cut the tunnel diameter by a factor of two or more. So a single road lane tunnel, according to regulations, has to be 26 feet, maybe 28 feet in diameter to allow for crashes and emergency vehicles and sufficient ventilation for combustion engine cars. But if you shrink that diameter to what we're attempting, which is 12 feet, which is plenty to get an electric skate through, you drop the diameter by a factor of 2 and the cross-sectional area by a factor of 4, and the tunneling cost scales with the cross-sectional area. So that's roughly a half order of magnitude improvement right there. Then tunneling machines currently tunnel for half the time, then they stop, and then the rest of the time is putting in reinforcements for the tunnel wall. So if you design the machine instead to do continuous tunneling and reinforcing, that'll give you a factor of 2 improvement. Combine that and it's a factor of 8. Also, these machines are far from being at their power or thermal limit. So you can jack up the power to the machine substantially. I think you can get at least a factor of 2, maybe a factor of 4 or 5 improvement on top of that. So I think there's a fairly straightforward series of steps to get somewhere in excess of an order of magnitude improvement in a cost per mile. And our target, actually, is we've got a pet snail called Gary. This is from Gary the snail from SpongeBob SquarePants. So Gary, currently, he's capable of going 14 times faster than a tunnel boring machine. We want to beat Gary. That will be victory. Victory is beating the snail.
But a lot of people dreaming about future cities, they imagine that actually the solution is sort of flying cars, drones, etc. You go above ground. Why isn't that a better solution? You save all that tunneling cost.
I do rockets. So I like things that fly. This is not some inherent bias against flying things. But there is a challenge with flying cars in that they'll be quite noisy. The wind force generated will be very high. Let's just say that if something's flying over your head, if there are a whole bunch of flying cars going all over the place, that is not an anxiety-reducing situation. You don't think to yourself, well, I feel better about today. You're thinking, like, did they service their hubcap? Or is it going to come off and guillotine me?
True. A quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. Tonight we're talking about the future, and Elon Musk, with his company Tesla, has shown himself to be at the forefront of the future when it comes to inventions. Let's get back to him in conversation with TED curator Chris Anderson, currently talking about creating tunnels under the congested streets of Southern California to alleviate accumulated traffic on surface streets.
So in looking at tunneling technology, it turns out that in order to make a tunnel, in order to seal against the water table, you've got to typically design a tunnel wall to be good to about 5 or 6 atmospheres. So to go to vacuum is only 1 atmosphere, or near vacuum. It sort of turns out that automatically, if you build a tunnel that is good enough to resist the water table, it is automatically capable of holding vacuum. If you were to do something like a DC to New York Hyperloop, I think you'd probably want to go underground the entire way because it's a high-density area. You're going under a lot of buildings and houses. And if you go deep enough, you cannot detect the tunnel. Sometimes people think, well, it's going to be pretty annoying to have a tunnel dug under my house. Like, if that tunnel is dug more than about 3 or 4 tunnel diameters beneath your house, you will not be able to detect it being dug at all. In fact, if you're able to detect the tunnel being dug, whatever device you're using, you can get a lot of money for that device from the Israeli military, who is trying to detect tunnels from Hamas, and from the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol that are trying to detect drug tunnels. So the reality is that Earth is incredibly good at absorbing vibrations, and once the tunnel depth is below a certain level, it is undetectable. Maybe if you have a very sensitive seismic instrument, you might be able to detect it.
So you've started a new company to do this called The Boring Company. Very funny. How much of your time is this?
It's maybe 2 or 3%.
You've called it a hobby. This is what an Elon Musk hobby looks like.
You know, this is basically interns and people doing it part-time. So this is, you know, some secondhand machinery, and it's kind of puttering along, but it's making good progress, so.
So an even bigger part of your time is being spent on electrifying cars and transport through Tesla. Is one of the motivations for the tunneling project the realization that actually in a world where cars are electric and where they're self-driving, there may end up being more cars on the roads on any given hour than there are now?
Exactly. A lot of people think that when you make cars autonomous, that they'll be able to go faster, and that will alleviate congestion. And to some degree, that will be true. But once you have shared autonomy where it's much cheaper to go by car, and you can go point to point, the affordability of of going in a car will be better than that of a bus. Like, it would cost less than a bus ticket. So the amount of driving that will occur will be much greater with shared autonomy, and actually traffic will get far worse.
I mean, you started Tesla with the goal of persuading the world that electrification was the future of cars.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, people were laughing at you. Now, not so much. I mean...
Okay.
Well, I mean, isn't
I don't
it
know.
True that, isn't it true that pretty much every auto manufacturer has announced serious electrification plans for the short to medium term future?
Yeah. I think almost every automaker has some electric vehicle program. They vary in seriousness. Some are very serious about transitioning entirely to electric, and some are just dabbling in it. And some, amazingly, are still pursuing fuel cells, but I think that won't last much longer.
But isn't there a sense, though, Elon, where you could now just declare victory and say, you know, we did it, let the world electrify, and you go on and focus on other stuff?
Yeah. Well, I intend to stay with Tesla as far into the future as I can imagine. There are a lot of exciting things that we have coming. The whole road system is meant to be navigated with passive optical or cameras. And so once you solve cameras' vision, then autonomy is solved. If you don't solve vision, it's not solved. So that's why our focus is so heavily on having a vision neural net that's very effective for road conditions.
Right. Many other people are going the LiDAR route. You want cameras plus radar is most of it.
You can absolutely be superhuman with just cameras. Like, you could probably do 10 times better than humans with just cameras.
So the new cars being sold right now have eight cameras in them. That they can't yet do. When will they be able to?
We're still on track for being able to go cross-country from L.A. to New York by the end of the year, fully autonomous.
So by the end of the year, you're saying someone's going to sit in a Tesla without touching the steering wheel, tap in New York, mm-hmm. off it goes.
Yeah.
Won't have to ever touch the wheel.
Yeah. Essentially, we should be able to go all the way from a parking lot in California to a parking lot in New York. No controls touched at any point during the entire journey.
Part of that is possible because you've already got a fleet of Teslas driving all these roads. You're accumulating a huge amount of data mm-hmm. of that national road system.
Yes. The thing that will be interesting is that I'm actually fairly confident it will be able to do that route even if you change the route dynamically. Like, it's if you say I'm going to be really good at one specific route, that's one thing, but it should be very good, certainly once you enter a highway, to go anywhere on the highway system in a given country. So it's not sort of limited to LA, New York. We could change it and make it Seattle, Florida, that day, in real time. So you were going from LA to New York, now go from LA to Toronto.
So leaving aside regulation for a second, in terms of the technology alone, the time when someone will be able to buy one of your cars and literally just take their hands off the wheel and go to sleep and wake up and find that they've arrived, how far away is that to do that
I
safely?
I think that's about 2 years. The real trick of it is not, you know, how do you make it work, say, 99.9% of the time? Because if a car crashes, say, 1 in 1,000 times, then you're probably still not going to be comfortable falling asleep. You know, you shouldn't be, certainly. but it's never going to be perfect. No system is going to be perfect. But if you say it's perhaps, the car is unlikely to crash in 100 lifetimes or 1,000 lifetimes, then people are like, okay, wow. If I would live 1,000 lives, I would still most likely never experience a crash, then that's probably okay.
Maybe, I guess a big concern of yours is that people may actually get seduced too early to think that this is safe and that you'll have some horrible incident happen that puts things back.
Well, I think that the autonomy system is likely to at least mitigate the crash, except in rare circumstances. The thing to appreciate about vehicle safety is this is probabilistic. I mean, there's some chance that any time a human driver gets in the car that they will have an accident. That is their fault. It's never zero. So the key threshold for autonomy is how much better does autonomy need to be than a person before you can rely on it.
But once you get that literally safe hands-off driving, The power to disrupt the whole industry seems massive, because at that point you've spoken of people being able to buy a car, drops you off at work, and then you let it go and provide a sort of Uber-like service to other people, earn you money, maybe even cover the cost of your lease of that car.
Exactly.
So you can kind of get a car for free. Is that really likely?
Yeah, absolutely this is what will happen. So there will be a shared autonomy fleet where you buy your car And you can choose to use that car exclusively. You could choose to have it be used only by friends and family, only by other drivers who are rated 5-star. You can choose to share it sometimes, but not other times. That's 100% what will occur. It's just a question of when.
So, listener, full disclosure here. I originally recorded this show over 2 years ago, in the middle of 2017. Listening to Elon Musk now, towards the end of 2019, something becomes clear. The actual future is not always the future we predict, so we shouldn't get our knickers in a twist too much about it, other than, of course, what common sense or justice dictates. Because the future does 180s sometimes, or it simply stalls, right? You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Tonight's show is The Future Revisited. I'm playing you part of a TED Talk, a conversation between the inventor and futurist Elon Musk and TED curator Chris Anderson. They're currently talking about the autonomous car that Elon Musk's Tesla company feels is very close to becoming reality. Tesla is not the only company, obviously, working on autonomous cars. Many other car makers are too. Musk, I think, feels possibly that he could be the closest to delivering. But Google is also working on an autonomous car. The thing is that though they're already being road tested, there are still some wrinkles. We do occasionally need to take the wheel in an emergency, and it could be more troublesome to take the wheel when we're not used to being in control of the car, when we've gotten in the habit of letting the car drive itself, than when we're always on the alert. There's something called skill atrophy, where when we're out of the habit of doing something, how to do it can go out of our minds quite quickly. And an instantaneous reaction is what's needed when a self-drive car can't figure things out for itself. In a Google test, that happened where a truck was partially blocking a parking lot entrance. There was plenty of room to go around it, but the unmanned car was uncertain what to do. It had been programmed that it needed to stay put when there was an obstruction, so it refused to move. And actually, even at a green light, the Google car had been trained to stop and think for a few seconds before proceeding. And when it was due to turn left and there were some chatty bicyclists in front of it, the Google car just waited for them to go. It didn't sit on its own horn. All good for road rage, but not so good for traffic jams. Also, the whole point of these autonomous cars is they're obviously computer generated, and you have to deal with this gabby voice going on and on about here's a coming lane change, here's a crosswalk, when you might just want to be listening to music. I imagine at some point you'll have the option to turn this off, but not as and when you're expected to jump in if there's anything the computer finds unfamiliar. There are still quite a few technical challenges to work out, things like snow or even rain that can scatter the beam of the car's laser sensor. Even with human drivers, you have to have a particular skill set to navigate a car in bad weather. And then there are, of course, quite a few legal challenges remaining, as in who's responsible for what in an accident, for instance. But, like with anything we adopt into our culture, these things eventually seem to get ironed out, and we forget what it was like before. And this will probably happen with self-drive cars and various other robotic activities that are going to take over many of the skills we've learnt and even gotten used to getting paid for. So beware, Uber drivers. Even with your current set of problems, having every car be its own Uber driver is an insurmountable one in terms of previous extra revenue. You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public radio station, KX93.5, talking tonight about the future and future innovation. Inventor and entrepreneur Elon Musk has made a name for himself by being at the forefront of such things. Here is more of his TED Talk, where he's in conversation with TED curator Chris Anderson. Here he's talking about another innovation he's working on, a new futuristic delivery truck. This one not autonomous and great fun to drive, it seems. Looks like a giant iPod with ghostly lights on the side from the peekaboo view Musk has provided.
It doesn't look like just a little friendly neighborhood truck. It looks kind of badass. What sort of semi is this?
So this is a heavy-duty, long-range semi-truck. So it's like the highest weight capability and with long range. Essentially, it's meant to alleviate the heavy-duty trucking loads. And this is something which people do not today think is possible. Could think the truck doesn't have enough power or it doesn't have enough range. So with the Tesla Semi, we want to show that an electric truck actually can out-torque any diesel semi. If you had a tug-of-war competition, the Tesla Semi will tug the diesel semi uphill.
That's pretty cool. In short term, these aren't driverless. These are going to be trucks that truck drivers want to drive.
Yes. What will be really fun about this is you have a flat torque RPM curve with an electric motor, whereas with a diesel motor or any kind of internal combustion engine car, you've got a torque RPM curve that looks like a hill. So this will be a very spry truck. You could drive this around like a sports car. There's no gears. It's like single speed.
There's a great movie to be made here somewhere. I don't know what it is, and I don't know that it ends well, but it's a great movie.
I mean, it's quite bizarre test driving. You know, when I was driving the test prototype for this truck, it's really weird because you're driving around and you're so nimble, and you're in this giant truck. I drove it around the parking lot. And I was like, this is crazy, making these mad maneuvers.
But groovy vehicles and high-speed travel aren't the only things Tesla's Elon Musk has up his sleeve. Here, as we related now on this KX935 sharing hour, he shows Ted's Chris Anderson an unrelated product he's developing.
This is just a cute house from Desperate Housewives or something. What on earth is going on here?
Well, this illustrates the picture of the future that I think is how things will evolve. You've got an electric car in the driveway. If you look in between the electric car and the house, there are actually three power walls stacked up against the side of the house. And then that house roof is a solar roof. So that's an actual solar glass roof.
So these roof tiles, some of them have in them solar power.
Yeah, so the solar glass tiles where you can adjust the texture and the color at a very fine-grained level. And then there's sort of micro louvers in the glass such that when you're looking at the roof from street level or close to street level, all the tiles look the same whether there is a solar cell behind it or not. So you have an even color from the ground level. If you were to look at it from a helicopter, you would be actually able to look through and see that some of the glass tiles have a solar cell behind them and some do not.
Right. You put them in the ones level that are likely to see a lot of sun.
Yes.
And that makes these roofs super affordable, right? They're not that much more expensive than just tiling the roof.
Yeah. We're very confident that a solar glass roof will be less than the cost of a normal roof plus the cost of electricity. So in other words, this will be economically a no-brainer. We think it'll look great, and it will last. I mean, we thought about like having the warranty be infinity, but then people thought, well, that might sound like we were just talking rubbish. But actually, this is toughened glass. Like, well, after the house has collapsed and there's nothing there, the roof tile, the glass tiles will still be there.
So you're rolling this out with like four different roofing types.
Yeah, we're starting off with two initially, and then the second two will be introduced early next year.
And what's the scale of ambition here? How many houses do you believe could end up having this type of roofing?
I mean, I think eventually almost all houses will have a solar roof. Now the thing is to consider the time scale here to be probably on the order of 40 or 50 years. So on average, a roof is replaced every 20 to 25 years. But you don't start replacing all roofs immediately. But eventually, if you say we were to fast forward to say 15 years from now, it will be unusual to have a roof that does not have solar.
Is there a mental model people don't get here that because of the shift in the cost economics of solar power that like most houses actually have enough sunlight on their roof pretty much to power all of their needs? If you could capture the power, you could go off grid kind of.
Yeah, it depends on where you are and what the house size is relative to the roof area. But yeah, it's a fair statement to say that most houses in the U.S. have enough roof area to power all the needs of the house.
Okay, so the key to the economic of these houses and the semi and the cars is the falling price of lithium-ion batteries, which you've made a huge bet on as Tesla. In many ways, that's almost the core competency. And you've decided that to really own that competency. You just have to build the world's largest manufacturing plant, kind of double the world's supply of lithium-ion batteries.
Yeah.
And they're actually being produced right now already and capable of producing eventually like 100 gigawatt hours of batteries a year.
100 gigawatt hours. We think probably more, but yeah.
One of your core ideas, Elon, about what makes an exciting future is a future where we no longer feel guilty about energy. Help us picture this. I mean, how many gigafactories, if you like, does it take to get us there?
About 100, roughly. It's not 10, it's not 1,000, most likely 100.
See, I kind of find this amazing. Like, you could actually picture what it would take to move the world off this vast fossil fuel thing. It's like you're building one, cost $5 billion, maybe the next one, or whatever, $5 to $10 billion. Yeah. Like, it's kind of cool that you can picture that project. And you're planning to do a Tesla, or at least announce another two this year.
I think we'll announce locations for somewhere between 2 and 4 gigafactories later this year. Yeah, probably 4.
Whoa. Like, where? Continent? you can say no.
We need to address a global market.
Yeah. Okay.
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is the future. Elon Musk is focused exactly on that. And I had to wonder what he was like as a child. He must have been quite impressive from our perspectives as adults, but he wouldn't have been seen like that at school. And predictably, he was bullied, according to his bio, so severely that he was once hospitalized when a group of boys threw him down the stairs and then beat him unconscious. Terrible, isn't it? But by age 12, he'd already taught himself computer programming and sold the code for a video game he created called Blaster. He sold it for about $500 in the early 1980s, and there's still a web version available. He got his BS from University of Pennsylvania and another in economics from Wharton. And by then, he must have been not quite such a nerd, because apparently, during that time, he and a fellow Penn student rented a 10-bedroom fraternity house and used it unofficially as a nightclub. He then moved here to California to begin a PhD in applied physics and materials science at Stanford, but he only lasted 2 days before he left to pursue his entrepreneurial aspirations in the areas of the internet, renewable energy, and outer space. Though born in South Africa, the son of an electromechanical engineer, pilot, and sailor, and a model and dietitian from Canada, he is now a fully-fledged US citizen.
So I have to ask you one question. I'm going to ask you one question about politics, only one. I'm kind of sick of politics, but I do need to ask you this. You're on a body now giving advice to a guy who has said he doesn't really believe in climate change, and there's a lot of people out there who kind of think you shouldn't be doing that. They'd like you to walk away from that. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I'm just on 2 advisory councils where the format consists of going around the room and asking people's opinion on things. And so there's like a meeting every month or two. It's a sum total of my contribution. To the degree that there are people in the room who are arguing in favor of doing something about climate change or other social issues. I mean, I've used the meetings I've had thus far to argue in favor of immigration and in favor of climate change. That wasn't on the agenda before. So maybe nothing will happen, but at least the words were said.
So let's talk SpaceX and Mars. Last time you were here, you spoke about what seemed like a kind of incredibly ambitious dream to develop rockets that were actually reusable, and you've only gone and done it. I mean, that's amazing. And several of these failed before you finally figured out how to get to do it. But now you've landed. You've done this what, 5 or 6 times?
I think we're on eight or nine, or something.
Yeah. And for the first time, you've actually reflown one of the rockets that landed. So
we landed the rocket booster and then prepped it for flight again and flew it again. So it's the first reflight of an orbital booster where that reflight is relevant. So it's important to appreciate that reusability is only relevant if it is rapid and complete. So like an aircraft or a car, you do not send your aircraft into Boeing in between flights.
Right. So it's really ambitious idea of sending like many, many, many people to Mars in 10 or 20 years' time, I guess, in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And you've designed this outrageous rocket to do it. Help us understand the scale of this thing. So if that was a skyscraper, that's like a 40-story skyscraper?
Maybe a little more, yeah. This configuration is about four times the thrust of the Saturn V moon rocket.
Four times the thrust of the biggest rocket humanity ever created before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in units of 747, like a 747 is only about a quarter million pounds of thrust. So for every 10 million pounds of thrust, there's 47. So this would be the thrust equivalent of 120 747s with all engines blazing.
And so even with a machine designed to escape Earth's gravity, this thing could actually take a fully loaded 747, people, cargo, everything, into orbit.
Exactly. This can take a fully loaded 747 with maximum fuel, maximum passengers, maximum cargo on the 747. This can take it as cargo.
So based on this, you presented recently this interplanetary transport system. This is a scene you picture, what, in 30th time, 20th time? People walking into this rocket.
I mean, I'm hopeful it's sort of in the eight to 10-year time frame. Aspirationally, that's our target. Our internal targets are more aggressive, but I think, yeah.
So this vehicle seems
quite large, and is large by comparison with other rockets. I think the future spacecraft will make this look like a rowboat. The future spaceships will be truly enormous.
Why, Elon? Because, like, why do we need to build a city on Mars with a million people on it in your lifetime, which I think is kind of what you've said you'd love to do?
Yeah, I think it's important to have a future that is inspiring and appealing. I mean, I just think that there have to be reasons that you get up in the morning and you want to live. Like, why do you want to live? What's the point? What inspires you? What do you love about the future? And if a future does not include being out there among the stars and being a multi-planet species, I find that it's incredibly depressing if that's not the future that we're going to have.
Well, people want to position this as an either-or, that there are so many desperate things happening on the planet now, from climate to poverty to, you know, you pick your issue. And this feels like a distraction. You shouldn't be thinking about this. You should be solving what's here and now. And to be fair, you've done a fair old bit to actually do that with your work on sustainable energy. But why not just do that?
Well, I think I look at the future from a standpoint of probabilities. It's like a branching stream of probabilities. And there are actions that we can take that affect those probabilities, or that accelerate one thing or slow down another thing, or, you know, introduce something new to the probability stream. Sustainable energy will happen no matter what. If there was no Tesla, if Tesla never existed, it would have to happen out of necessity. It's tautological. If you don't have sustainable energy, it means you have unsustainable energy. Eventually you'll run out, and the laws of economics will drive civilization towards sustainable energy, inevitably. The fundamental value of a company like Tesla is the degree to which it accelerates the advent of sustainable energy faster than it would otherwise occur. If it accelerated that by a decade, potentially more than a decade, that would be quite a good thing to occur. That's what I consider to be the fundamental sort of aspirational good of Tesla. Then there's becoming a multi-planet species and space-faring civilization. This is not inevitable. It's very important to appreciate this is not inevitable. The sustainable energy future, I think, is largely inevitable, but being a space-faring civilization is definitely not inevitable. If you look at progress in space, in 1969, we were able to send somebody to the moon. 1969. Then we had the space shuttle. The space shuttle could only take people to low Earth orbit, and the United States could take no one to orbit. So that's the trend. If people are mistaken, they think that technology just automatically improves. It does not automatically improve. It only improves if a lot of people work very hard to make it better. And actually, I think it will by itself degrade. You look at great civilizations like ancient Egypt, and they're able to make the pyramids, and they forgot how to do that. And the Romans, they built these incredible aqueducts. They forgot how to do it.
It almost seems, listening to you and look at the different things you've done, that you've got this unique double motivation on everything that I find so interesting. One is this desire to work for humanity's long-term good. The other is this desire to do something exciting. And it feels like you need the one to drive the other. With Tesla, you want to have sustainable energy, so you make these super sexy, exciting cars to do it. Solar energy, we need to get there, so we need to make these beautiful roofs. We haven't even spoken about your newest thing, which you want to save humanity from bad AI. And so you're going to create this really cool brain-machine interface to give us all infinite memory and telepathy and so forth. And on Mars, it feels like what you're saying is, yeah, we need to save humanity and have a backup plan, but also we need to inspire humanity. And this is a way to inspire.
I think the value of fueling inspiration is very much underrated, no question. But I want to be clear, I'm not trying to be anyone's savior. I'm just trying to think about the future and not be sad.
The fact that in your mind you dream this stuff, you dream stuff that no one else would dare dream, or no one else would be capable of dreaming at the level of complexity you do. The fact that you do that, Elon Musk, is a really remarkable thing. Thank you for helping us all to dream a bit bigger.
You'll tell me if it ever starts getting genuinely insane, right?
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5. My topic tonight is the future. We've just heard of some practical changes coming in the world at large. But what about our own emotional place in our own futures? We're not naturally as existential as other animals. We project our future emotional states as well as the physical ones. Our brains are complicated. When we recall a past event, the hippocampus has to combine three distinct pieces of information: what happened, when it happened, and where it happened. And they're each stored in a different part of the brain. Researchers have found that the same circuitry is activated when people imagine a new scene. The hippocampus combines those three things: what, when, where. But this time, it scrambles the information to create something new. Even when you think you're relaxing, your brain is continually recombining information to imagine the future, according to researchers who've studied the brain. When your mind wanders, it's simulating future possibilities, which is why we can respond quickly to unexpected developments. What we may call that gut feeling is actually the result of those previous simulations. So let's say you get an email from a colleague inviting you to a party, and something in you says that you think you turned down a previous invitation, so now you feel you have to accept this one. But then you imagine you're not going to have a great time because he's not very good company when he's drinking. But then you think, well, I've never invited him to my place and don't really want to, so maybe accepting the invitation would be better, because turning this one down when you've already rejected him once would make him resentful, and that would be problematic at work. Okay, so you've expended quite a bit of time and energy going through all these simulations, but actually that's exactly what Google does when it responds to your query in less than a split second. That's because it hasn't just considered what you've asked that minute. It's already predicted what you might ask in the future. And your brain does the same prospection, but in the form of emotions. Emotions are there to guide your future behavior and moral judgments, according to researchers. They enable empathy by predicting the reactions of others. And so once you imagine how both you and your colleague will feel if you turn down the invitation, you know that you'd better say yes, let's do it. It seems a lot of the reason why we humans don't like to think about the future is because we fear death. But the funny thing is, we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about our deaths or managing our fear of it. We're more likely to fear other people's deaths. It's also why we don't overly dwell on the past, because there's nothing we can do about it. Really, the future is all we've got. And that's actually how we became the wise man, Homo sapiens, by spending our present dreaming up, forging, and shaping the future for ourselves. But what if we dream a wrong one? What if we screw ourselves? I'm going to bring in here Andrew McAfee from his TED Talk to consider whether we're on the right track headed into the future being my topic on tonight's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 93.5.
The writer George Eliot cautioned us that among all forms of mistake, prophecy is the most gratuitous. The person that we would all acknowledge as her 20th century counterpart, Yogi Berra, agreed. He said, "It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." I'm going to ignore their cautions and make one very specific forecast. In the world that we are creating very quickly, we're going to see more and more things that look like science fiction, and fewer things that look like jobs.
He mentions the driverless cars Elon Musk was just talking about and the fact that we won't need truck drivers. Plus,
we're going to hook Siri up to Watson and use that to automate a lot of the work that's currently done by customer service reps and troubleshooters and diagnosers. And we're already taking R2-D2, painting him orange, and putting him to work carrying shelves around warehouses, which means we need a lot fewer people to be walking up and down those aisles. Now, for about 200 years, people have been saying exactly what I'm telling you, that the age of technological unemployment is at hand, starting with the Luddites smashing looms in Britain just about two centuries ago. And they have been wrong. Our economies in the developed world have coasted along on something pretty close to full employment, which brings up a critical question: why is this time different, if it really is? The reason it's different is that just in the past few years, our machines have started demonstrating skills they have never, ever had before. Understanding, speaking, hearing, seeing, answering, writing, and they're still acquiring new skills. For example, mobile humanoid robots are still incredibly primitive, but I think the day is not too far off at all when we're going to have androids doing a lot of the work that we are doing right now. And we're creating a world where there is going to be more and more technology and fewer jobs. It's a world that Eric Brynjolfsson and I are calling the new machine age. The thing to keep in mind is that this is absolutely great news. This is the best economic news on the planet these days. Not that there's a lot of competition, right? This is the best economic news we have these days for two main reasons. The first is technological progress is what allows us to continue this amazing recent run that we're on, where output goes up over time, while at the same time, prices go down, and volume and quality just continue to explode. Now, some people look at this and talk about shallow materialism, but that's absolutely the wrong way to look at it. This is abundance, which is exactly what we want our economic system to provide. The second reason that the new machine age is such great news is that once the androids start doing jobs, we don't have to do them anymore, and we get freed up from drudgery and toil. Now, when I talk about this with my friends in Cambridge and Silicon Valley, they say, fantastic, no more drudgery, no more toil. This gives us the chance to imagine an entirely different kind of society, a society where the creators and the discoverers and the performers and the innovators come together with their patrons and their financiers to talk about issues, entertain, enlighten, provoke each other. And there's actually a huge amount of truth here. We are seeing an amazing flourishing taking place in a world where it is just about as easy to generate an object as it is to print a document. We have amazing new possibilities. The people who used to be craftsmen and hobbyists are now makers, and they're responsible for massive amounts of innovation. And artists who were formerly constrained can now do things that were never, ever possible for them before. We are in the middle of an astonishing period. Which brings up another great question: what could possibly go wrong?
And TED speaker Andrew McAfee is going to let us know just that. You're tuned to The Sharer now on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James. My topic tonight is the future. But don't forget, what makes it a little more interesting is it's the future as imagined over 2.5 years ago when I originally recorded this show in 2017.
We're going to face two really thorny sets of challenges as we head deeper into the future that we're creating. The first are economic, and they're really nicely summarized in an apocryphal story about a back and forth between Henry Ford II and Walter Reuther, who was the head of the auto workers union. They were touring one of the new modern factories, and Ford playfully turns to Reuther and says, "Hey, Walter, how are you going to get these robots to pay union dues?" And Reuther shoots back, "Hey, Henry, how are you going to get them to buy cars?" Reuther's problem in that anecdote is that it is tough to offer your labor to an economy that's full of machines. And we see this very clearly in the statistics. If you look over the past couple decades at the returns to capital, in other words, corporate profits, we see them going up, and we see that they're now at an all-time high. If we look at the returns to labor, in other words, total wages paid out in the economy, we see them at an all-time low and heading very quickly in the opposite direction. So this is clearly bad news for Reuther. It looks like it might be great news for Ford, but it's actually not. If you want to sell huge volumes of somewhat expensive goods to people, you really want a large, stable, prosperous middle class. We have had one of those in America for just about the entire post-war period, but the middle class is clearly under huge threat right now. We all know a lot of the statistics, but just to repeat one of them, median income in America has actually gone down over the past 15 years, and we're in danger of getting trapped in some vicious cycle where inequality and polarization continue to go up over time. The societal challenges that come along with that kind of inequality deserve some attention. There's no shortage of dystopian visions about what happens when our machines become self-aware and they decide to rise up and coordinate attacks against us. I'm going to start worrying about those the day my computer becomes aware of my printer. So this is not the set of challenges we really need to worry about. To tell you the kinds of societal challenges that are going to come up in the new machine age, I want to tell a story about two stereotypical American workers. And to make them really stereotypical, let's make them both white guys. And the first one is a college-educated, professional, creative type, manager, engineer, doctor, lawyer, that kind of worker. We're going to call him Ted. He's at the top of the American middle class. His counterpart is not college educated and works as a laborer, works as a clerk, does low-level white-collar or blue-collar work in the economy. We're going to call that guy Bill. And if you go back about 50 years, Bill and Ted were leading remarkably similar lives. For example, in 1960, they were both very likely to have full-time jobs, working at least 40 hours a week. But as the social researcher Charles Murray has documented, as we started to automate the economy, and 1960 is just about when computers started to be used by businesses, as we started to progressively inject technology and automation and digital stuff into the economy, the fortunes of Bill and Ted diverged a lot. Over this time frame, Ted has continued to hold a full-time job. Bill hasn't. In many cases, Bill has left the economy entirely, and Ted very rarely has. Over time, Ted's marriage has stayed quite happy. Bill's hasn't. And Ted's kids have grown up in a two-parent home, while Bill's absolutely have not over time. Other ways that Bill is dropping out of society, he's decreased his voting in presidential elections, and he started to go to prison a lot more often. So I cannot tell a happy story about these social trends, and they don't show any signs of reversing themselves. They're also true no matter which ethnic group or demographic group we look at, and they're actually getting so severe that they're in danger of overwhelming even the amazing progress we made with the civil rights movement. And what my friends in Silicon Valley and Cambridge are overlooking is that they're Ted. They're living these amazingly busy, productive lives, and they've got all the benefits to show from that, while Bill is leading a very different life. They're actually both proof of how right Voltaire was when he talked about the benefits of work and the fact that it saves us from not one, but three great evils.
Those three evils being boredom, vice, and need. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is the future, and you're currently listening to Andrew McAfee from his TED Talk on what's going to happen to our jobs in the future, what's actually already to a large extent happening because of automation and humanized, if you will, machinery.
So what do we do about it? The economic playbook is surprisingly clear, surprisingly straightforward. In the short term especially, the robots are not going to take all of our jobs in the next year or two, so the classic Econ 101 playbook is going to work just fine. Encourage entrepreneurship, double down on infrastructure, and make sure we're turning out people from our educational system with the appropriate skills. But over the longer term, if we are moving into an economy that's heavy on technology and light on labor, and we are, then we have to consider some more radical interventions. For example, something like a guaranteed minimum income. Now, that's probably making some folk uncomfortable because that idea is associated with the extreme left wing and with fairly radical schemes for redistributing wealth. I did a little bit of research on this notion, and it might calm some folk down to know that the idea of a net guaranteed minimum income has been championed by those frothing-at-the-mouth socialists, Friedrich Hayek, Richard Nixon, and Milton Friedman.
He's joking, naturally.
And if you find yourself worried that something like a guaranteed income is going to stifle our drive to succeed and make us kind of complacent. You might be interested to know that social mobility, one of the things we really pride ourselves on in the United States, is now lower than it is in the Northern European countries that have these very generous social safety nets. So the economic playbook is actually pretty straightforward. The societal one is a lot more challenging. I don't know what the playbook is for getting Bill to engage and stay engaged throughout life. I do know that education is a huge part of it. I witnessed this firsthand. I was a Montessori kid for the first few years of my education. And what that education taught me is that the world is an interesting place, and my job is to go explore it. The school stopped in third grade, so then I entered the public school system, and it felt like I had been sent to the gulag. With the benefit of hindsight, I now know the job was to prepare me for life as a clerk or a laborer, but at the time, it felt like the job was to kind of bore me into some submission with what was going on around me. We have to do better than this. We cannot keep turning out bills.
And by bills, the TED speaker you're listening to now here on my KX95 Sharon Hour, Andrew McAfee, is referring to a generic person, your regular Bill, a working-class tradesman versus a college-educated professional.
So we see some green shoots that things are getting better. We see very prominent business voices telling us we need to rethink some of the things that we've been holding dear for a while. We see technology deeply impacting education and engaging people from our youngest learners up to our oldest ones. And we see very serious and sustained and data-driven efforts to understand how to intervene in some of the most troubled communities that we have. So the green shoots are out there. I don't want to pretend for a minute that what we have is going to be enough. We're facing very tough challenges. To give just one example, there are about 5 million Americans who have been unemployed for at least 6 months. We're not going to fix things for them by sending them back to Montessori. And my biggest worry is that we're creating a world where we're going to have glittering technologies embedded in kind of a shabby society and supported by an economy that generates inequality instead of opportunity. But I actually don't think that's what we're going to do. I think we're going to do something a lot better for one very straightforward reason. The facts are getting out there. The realities of this new machine age and the change in the economy are becoming more widely known. If we wanted to accelerate that process, we could do things like have our best economists and policymakers play Jeopardy against Watson. We could send Congress on an autonomous car road trip. And if we do enough of these kinds of things, the awareness is going to sink in that things are going to be different. And then we're off to the races, because I don't believe for a second that we have forgotten how to solve tough challenges or that we have become too apathetic or hard-hearted to even try. I started my talk with quotes from wordsmiths who were separated by an ocean and a century. Let me end it with words from politicians who are similarly distant. Winston Churchill came to my home of MIT in 1949, and he said, "If we are to bring the broad masses of the people in every land to the table of abundance, it can only be by the tireless improvement of all of our means of technical production." Abraham Lincoln realized there was one other ingredient. He said, "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to give them the plain facts." So the optimistic note that I want to leave you with is that the plain facts of the machine age are becoming clear, and I have every confidence that we're going to use them to chart a good course into the challenging, abundant economy that we're creating.
How about you, listener? Are you encouraged or discouraged by the way we're going into the future? If you want to listen to this again, you can do so by going to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. Or you can listen on iTunes. And talking about the future, do come back in future. The Sharon Hour airs with me, Sharon James, every Monday night at 9 p.m.